Okay, it's week six. A beautiful day. Thank you for being here. We have the normal progression of things. I have a couple handouts here. There's one handout on a patent, and this is assignment two here. So if you haven't gotten one of those, please pick it up. I want to remind the students working on projects that I want to get in touch with them at least weekly to make sure that they're on schedule for the rest of the quarter. And I know I'm meeting with one team after class and another team next week. So I want to make that a weekly thing just for, you know, 5 minutes or so. So that would be good. I also want to say that on the last day of class, which is March 11th, that's when you'll be giving the teams will be giving presentations. And after the presentations, there will be a social event afterwards, complete with food and drink outside here. So I want to make sure that you write down in your calendar to keep that time open, because it should be a lot of fun. And you're welcome to invite your friends and stuff. We are going to put them to work in reviewing the presentations, and I will be sending out an RSVP for that event, so I know exactly how much goodies to get, okay? Tuesday, March 11th, right after class. Website, I update it, you know, weekly. Next week we'll have two presentations. The first one will be by my former VA colleague, Doug Schwant, and he's an expert mechanical engineer, and he's going to be talking about some of the projects that he's worked on and how he works on the projects, what tools and resources he uses to be successful in his projects. And in the second half of the class, we're going to hear a talk about human consent in dealing with projects with people. There is a form that needs to be signed, and people that you work with have to know what their rights are and what the benefits and risks of being in a study involve. And so we're going to hear about how to do that. So that ought to be very enlightening and new for everybody. So it'll be good. Any questions? It's good to know that everybody knows it all. Well, today we have Jeff Schock and presenting. And besides being a fellow alumnus of the University of Michigan, Jeffrey is a registered patent attorney and the founding member of Schock's Patent Group, which is very coincidental to join a group that's actually named after him. And that's a patent law firm in San Francisco devoted to startup ventures. He has 10 years of experience in patent law and has been involved in over 200 patent applications. And here at Stanford, he teaches courses patent law and strategy and patent prosecution. And Jeff is not a stranger to engineering either. He has contributed to both the University of Michigan solar car project and the General Motors EV1, and is actively involved in cultivating environmentally conscious inventions. So let's bring Jeff up to the podium.
Who here has actually been named on a patent application? A couple. Great. Any issued patents? Yeah. Couple. We're talking about patents today. We're talking about assisting technologies. Why are we talking about patents? Aren't patents just for big companies? Aren't patents to prevent others from doing what we're doing? What don't we want this particular we're working on to be able to be in the hands of everyone or as many people as possible? Why are we even talking about patent law? Should I just leave? Or is there... Yeah.
If somebody's going to be manufacturing this thing, they'll want some sort of protection for the intellectual property involved.
Right.
Otherwise, they'll just say, there's no profit in it.
Maybe there's actually a device that's going to be made. Maybe there are two things that have to happen there. Maybe you need to raise some capital. Maybe you need to raise some capital because you're going to get some tools and some dies and some factory or to put this thing together. Or you need to have a sales to use this. You need to be able to have some people on your team and you're raising some capital. Those angel investors saying, wow, that's a great idea. That's going to help a lot. How's it going to make me money? And then when they ask that particular question, they're going to want to know what is the particular way that we're going to prevent other people from simply copying this design and being able to jump into this market? Essentially, how do I protect I'm an investor? This is one way. Any other reasons why you might file for a patent application? What if you didn't want to make it? What if you just license it to someone else? But yet you wanted to be able to have some control over that. You wanted to be able to say, all right, I'm going to give it to you, but if you don't actually do anything with it, if you don't actually penetrate the market like I'm hoping you will, if you don't do these particular types of, give particular types of instructions or do these types of you're able to prevent anyone else, from doing, making, using the device. And so by doing that, you're going to be able to have control over that device and who does actually make and use this. So there's a couple reasons that you may want to actually pursue patent protection. I think there's a good background here, so I'm not going to talk any more about me, other than the fact that I'm also an angel investor. I'm a member of the Keiretsu Forum. It's one of the largest angel investor networks. And that's relevant in these types of projects, class projects, because maybe someday you want to actually talk to someone about raising money. And that particular group is a fairly large one and often invest in similar devices. So today is going to be about, my lecture today is going to be about this debunking this particular myth that there is some kind of relationship between trying to get a patent and whether or not your particular product infringes someone else's patent. So you went out, spent 10 grand on a patent attorney and said, all right, go give me a patent. Took a couple of years, and at the end of those couple of years, you actually have an issued patent. Do you think that you would be able to actually go out and make that particular product? You have a patent on it. You spend a bunch of money. Wouldn't you think that you would be able to actually make this? A couple heads are nodding. Well, fine. Why not? Because you have a patent on this, right? You should be able to say, all right, here's my particular grant from the government to be able to make this. It's actually not that way at all. And actually, the patents that you get on your particular invention has actually nothing to do with whether or not you can make and use this, whether or not you actually infringe someone else's patent. We'll talk about that, explore that today. So in front of you is a patent. The only reason I provided this is simply if you've never seen one before. The front page is just a bibliographic page. It talks about who the inventors are, when it was filed, when it was issued, who owned it when it was issued, maybe just a pretty picture that talks about, you know, that's indicative of what's going on with a particular invention, and a quick little abstract that has actually no legal significance whatsoever. That's the front page. If you flip to the second page, this is the beginning of the technical section. So it's that line over there, just sheet 1 of 3. It goes on for another couple sheets, 3 sheets exactly. And those are the drawings. Those, some of the different embodiments, some of the different versions, some of the different views. The next page after that talks about a bunch of text. On the very top, it's the actual title of the invention. We got a technical field, a background, brief description of the figures, and then this very long section called Description of the Preferred Embodiments. That goes on for about a page, page and a half. And all that right there, from the drawings to the end of that section, the beginning of the next section says, I claim. And so that section right there is called the technical section. The technical section is there for one reason, and one reason only. It's there to enable someone to make and use this particular invention. This is, in some ways, is our Library of Congress. This is our library of technical innovation in the United States. The patents that we have. 7 million patents, actually. And this section right here, that technical section, teaches you how to make this particular invention. You have to have that section. And if you don't do that, if you don't actually teach someone how to make and use your invention, then you don't get a patent. Section right after that is the legal section, or the claims. And it starts off, I claim, or we claim. There's a one, and then a sentence. All those phrases right there are actually within one sentence. Capital letter in the beginning and a period at the end. The next couple of claims, actually the rest of the claims, 2 through 20, are dependent claims. They simply just further define what is going on in the independent claim. Those claims define what the legal boundaries of the particular patent are. The legal rights of the inventor, the legal rights of the owner of this particular patent, are defined right here in the claims, the legal section. So please, just a real quick review. There's a technical section, the drawings, the detailed description that teach you how to make and use it, and then there's the legal section that define the legal boundaries. Pretty simple. What are the requirements of a patent? Yeah?
It has to be novel. It has to provide some new concept.
Exactly. Novelty. I heard unobviousness. Unobviousness is the next one. It cannot be obvious to one skilled in the art at the time of the invention. Third one? That's a little bit more on the timing stuff, but yes, you're absolutely right. Those are requirements. But there's another one that's kind of like typically talked about in this group of three. It's the utility. It must be useful. At some point, the patent office was actually examining patents to figure out whether or not they were good for society. Then it gets a little confusing. Because at some point, gambling machines were illegal, but then they weren't anymore. And so, if something's illegal and then it's not, is it useful or not useful then, but is useful now? Radar detectors. There's some decent amount of technology that goes into a radar detector. They're legal in some states, not legal in others. Is that useful? Is it good for society? Patent officers threw up their arms and said, we're not even going to consider this question anymore. We're not going to consider whether it's useful for society. We're just going to say, does it do the particular function that it says it does? And if it does, then it's useful. So the utility, the usefulness requirement is really actually fairly easy. The novelty requirement is simply, has this been done exactly like this before? That's relatively easy to satisfy that. The hardest one is this concept of, is your particular invention obvious? Would it be obvious to one skilled in the arts, someone that has some training in this particular field that you're in, to combine a bunch of things that have been done in the past to reach your particular invention? Those are the requirements. So let's actually put these tests into action. Over here we have a flashlight that has a hand cranked on it. There's a little battery in there. You could see the little the leads. Over here we just have a pretty standard 1970s Panasonic transistor radio. And on the right we have a radio that has a hand crank. It's got a little spring in there, and so you could crank this thing and that spring will hold the energy. And you can go ahead and play the radio whenever you want. Is this thing patentable? What's that? Combining the two ideas might be patentable. Yep, so what is this going to come down to? We just walked through the three requirements. Is this thing useful? Sure. You could use it in your camp. You don't have to carry any batteries with you. Sure, this thing's useful. Is it novel? Yeah, it's novel because it doesn't actually look like this and doesn't actually look like this. It's actually different. So it's novel. So the big question is it obvious? And that's actually what it almost always comes down to. Is this thing over here an obvious combination of, hey, here's a little crank right there and here's the radio right there? Yes.
Within the context of just this slide, yes, okay, it's novel. But did you leaf through back issues of Popular Mechanics from 1950 and try to decide if anybody had ever done this before?
I personally did not.
We're
just gonna restrict it just to these two things that we have. So if the prior art only includes these two things, is this thing obvious? Who could make an argument that says, like, sure, it's obvious? It's pretty obvious? Sure. So there's some kind of motivation to actually put these two things together. Who here might argue that it's not obvious? Yeah.
Well, it's not necessarily, since it hasn't been done before, radios and cranks have been around for a while, spring one launches, it clearly hasn't been obvious. Nobody's done it.
No one's done it. This thing over here looks like it's pretty ancient. It actually is. So maybe the spring-loaded aspect might have something to do with it. Anyone else? Why this wouldn't be obvious? Turns out that this is actually a really good question. Whether or not this was obvious, they fought and fought and fought in the patent office, and fought to the point where the patent office said it's not going to be patentable because this thing is obvious. And they said, no, there's something here, and they took it up on appeal. And they took it up on appeal from that. And so this question right here is actually a pretty good one. What all came down to it, though, is that this particular patent was patentable because of this thing right here. There's a power circuit in that particular hand crank radio. The power circuit is there because when you crank this thing, that particular spring is going to have a heck of a lot of energy. And you want a slow release of that. You don't really care in a flashlight if you turn it on and it's really, really bright and then it dims. In fact, that might actually be a good design. It's really bright when you first need it, when you first turn it on. But that's not what you want with a radio. You don't want to put a radio over here and turn up the volume so that it's perfect, and you're listening to it, and you're listening to it, and everything's great, and then it gets a lot softer, and it gets really soft because the spring is starting to lose its energy. Then you have to go over here and turn it up again, and you have to crank up the volume so that you could actually hear it. And so then, like, this, you need some kind of controlled release of this particular energy. So there was something there. And so the question that I was asking earlier of, is this thing obvious? There's something inside of this radio that helps get over this particular technical problem if you just threw these two things together. And so the question of, is this thing obvious, kind of turns to, well, what's some of the problems that you had to overcome? When you're putting these two things together, what did you have to do? And is that particular thing that you came up with found in the prior art? And if it's not, then maybe this thing is patentable. All right, let's try this again. We got our little hand crank radio. We got AM and FM on there. And now we're going to have another version of it. Little hand crank radio. But this one gets XM, satellite radio. Is this thing patentable?
What does it mean by mechanical storage?
That's Spring. Fancy language for Spring.
What are you claiming?
That's an interesting question. So it might actually come down to, what are the claims? Again, what are the requirements?
XM is in a specific radio frequency, and it may or may not be encoded.
Okay. Let's go step back to the real basics, though. Is this patentable? What are the three questions?
Is it useful, but we don't really care about that anymore?
Yeah, it's useful. Of course it's useful. It's got a radio. It's play some music. Is it new? Is it novel? Nope. This one is just AM, FM. So it's novel, right? It's new.
What part of it's novel?
The fact that it gets XM. That hasn't been done in this radio right there. Novelty is simply, has this been done just like this before? So it's novel. The biggest question, and it always is a big question, is this thing obvious? Would it be obvious to throw XM into a radio? I see a couple of heads that are shaking yes. Anyone that could argue why it's not obvious to do this? There might be just something really funky about, like, how do you actually pull down these satellite radio waves? And it might be something really difficult about how you get this little radio to be able to do that. But barring that, this thing is probably not patentable.
This thing might be actually charging a battery rather than powering.
And it might need to do that just because it's doing satellite and it has to have a higher charge. Sure. But barring those things, I don't think that thing's probably patentable. So what do we have here? The summary is, if you can draft a claim, if you could define this one sentence that helps distinguish your particular invention from everything that's been done in the past, then your particular invention is patentable. This is the patentable side of the lecture. And I'm about to flip over to the other side of the lecture. So any questions on patentability first? Yeah.
Hasn't the obviousness legislation changed in the last couple of years?
There's a big case called KSR that came down from the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court essentially was trying to make it so that it's harder to get patents, which is probably a good idea. Because I think the Patent Office, and most patent attorneys would agree, that the Patent Office has been issuing too many patents. It's too easy to get a patent. Right now, it's challenging to come up with the right rule. Of how do you come up with a rule? This is a fairly subjective test, right? I mean, I asked a bunch of people, hey, is this thing obvious? Is it not obvious? Some people are shaking their head yes. Some people are shaking their head no. It's a fairly subjective test. How do you get 4,000 examiners that are examining a different patent application every single day, every single work day? How do you get them all on the same page so that they're all doing the same exact subjective test every single day across 4,000 examiners in a government agency that doesn't pay very well? It's not all that easy. And so the patent office had came up with this teaching suggestion motivation test. I'm not going to get into the details, but it was a test that you could essentially apply and then you could figure out whether or not something was obvious. It let in too many patents, or it approved too many patents, patent applications, but it was something that you could do and it had a great repeatability. And the Supreme Court came in and said, no, we don't want you to apply this rigid rule all the time. We just want you to apply whatever rule makes sense for that particular case. Essentially, the Supreme Court is saying, it's kind of like pornography. You know it when you see it. Use your common sense. Patent attorneys were just pulling out their hair when they heard this. Because now all of a sudden, like, I can't give you the answer. Someone comes to me and says, is this thing patentable? I don't know. Depends on what examiner you get and what day you got. And so maybe it was a little bit better in some ways before because it was a clear-cut test. And it had great repeatability. And now maybe it's a little bit better because, okay, well, now we're going to reduce the ability for patent applications to slide through the patent office. But I kind of long for the days where I could actually tell my client whether or not to file a $10,000 patent application. Is there another question? Yeah. So maybe they're going back to what we had over here. Remember at first when I said, is this thing patentable? It didn't really look patentable. Like everyone was saying, oh, this thing is obvious. But there was something kind of special that was going on there. And when you look at the claim, and this is what they define, and this is what the invention is, or what they got, the patent, is this thing right here. It is very specific, and actually spends a decent amount of words talking about this control circuit. And so it's quite possible that some of the stents patents are talking about something very, very specific. And when you look at the pages, when you look at the designs or the drawings, they all kind of look alike. But the claims themselves are claiming something different. Yeah?
Isn't a possible test the test of time as to whether somebody can test it or not? So if somebody can test it over 10 years, you're safe?
Contested in terms of...
saying, well, that's my idea. I mean, here's an established write-up of an idea, and if nobody...
There's no period in which if you don't contest a particular patent or it hasn't been contested, then it turns out that it's kind of foolproof or it kind of has this golden seal or anything like that or bulletproof. You're allowed to fight to invalidate a patent at any point during the entire pendency of that particular patent.
So it's been validated. In other words, somebody fighting it
There's a higher confidence. Yes, there's a higher confidence level in that. But any other particular would-be infringer is allowed to actually have their day in court and to be able to say, I want you to look at this particular issue. There's sometimes where the courts will say, we've already looked at that piece of prior art. We've already looked at that article from the 1950s. We've already looked at this design, this particular product from the late 70s. We're not going to look at it again. And so there's part of that that happens where if you bring up some prior art to try to invalidate a patent and the court's already looked at it, the court's not going to look again. But there's always another product out there. There's always another article out there. Just find another one. Are there any other questions on the patentability side before we move on? Okay. So what are considered the actions that would be an infringement of a patent? Another way of asking this question would be, what would you want someone to stop doing if you held the patent? Selling. Making. Selling. Using. Those are actually the verbs. Whoever, without authority, makes, uses, or sells, or imports into the United States a particular product or uses a particular method that's covered by a patent within the term of that particular patent infringes that patent. Just want to make one little note. Is filing a patent application part of this? If you filed a patent application, is that an infringement? No. Because filing a patent application really isn't any of those four verbs, is it? Just keep that in mind. Because a lot of people talk about, oh, your particular patent infringes my patent. Patents can infringe patents. The only thing that can infringe is whether when you make, use, sell, or import. Yes? Sure. So we're going to try to tackle that exact issue of does filing a patent application actually give you the right to actually import it? It doesn't. It doesn't at all. The patent is only going to be able to help you stop others from importing it. It doesn't actually, it's not a positive right. It's actually a negative right. That will all come into, hopefully, will all be clear by the end of the lecture. Yes? Well, if you're exporting it, you're probably doing one of these other things. So if you have, so if there's a United States patent on a particular product, say this particular container lid, my little adult sippy cup, and there's a U.S. patent on this, can you actually go to Canada and make it and use it and sell it in Canada? Sure. It's a U.S. patent. The United States has absolutely no jurisdiction whatsoever to go into Canada and stop you from doing something in Canada. Nope, because that would be importing. I mean, you could make it there and keep it there and then like come across the border. But if you came across the border with it, you know, in tow, then that's going to be importing. So this is geographical. There is no such thing as a worldwide patent. There's this process called a PCT, which is an international patent application. But there is no worldwide patent. The patent application, the worldwide patent application, is kind of like this one stop where you file it there. The patent office examines it. That patent office is either Japan, Europe, or the United States. Those particular patent offices, they will examine your particular patent application and say, yep, this is ready to roll. But from there, you have to go into the individual countries to actually get a patent. There is no such thing as a worldwide patent. And when you hear that, you have to know that person is just not right, is wrong. If you have a French patent and I'm in Spain, I could go ahead and make, use, and sell this thing in Spain and in Germany and the UK. And it doesn't matter as long as I don't go into France. I think that was my example. So that gets a little tricky in terms of like where are you and who is where is that being hosted? But if you're actually in the United States, it depends on actually the language of the claim. If the claim talks about downloading this particular application and then using that particular application, and you're in the United States, then yes, actually infringe that. But if that claim language was uploading or providing that, and you're not doing any of those things in the United States, and the only person who is doing those things is someone in Canada, you're not going to infringe. So it gets a little tricky when it gets into kind of the web. Keep in mind that patents expire after a particular term. They can't be renewed. You can't just file a patent application again. They expire. That go into the public domain, and anyone can make, use, and sell that particular invention once it expires.
So you can have someone else issue a patent with this? When you say you can't renew it, can
Oh, no, because it wouldn't be patentable anymore, because that thing has been around for 20 years. And so it wouldn't satisfy any of the requirements. Yes? It starts when you file it. It used to be 17 from issue, and it used to take about 3 years to get from filing to issue, and now it's just 20 from filing. Yes. Sometimes the United States Patent Office will kind of give you more time at the end because they took too much time to examine your particular patent application. They will extend it for you. Yes.
Speaking of pharmaceuticals, is that 20-year number different for pharmaceuticals?
Nope. And there's been a great kind of academic debate of like how long that should be. Because it seems like a really, really long time for software and a really, really short time for pharmaceuticals. But the problem is that it's really difficult to draw a line and be able to say, this is a pharmaceutical and this is a software. It kind of sounds pretty easy on that level. But what if you're talking about a particular software that's designing pharmaceuticals? What if you're talking about some of the kind of bio information type of software that's out there that kind of deals a lot with the actual body and starts kind of getting into doing a lot of diagnostics. Like, is that a pharmaceutical or is that a software? And I could probably write it to make it look like either one. And so some academics will say, like, oh, would this be great if we just kind of adjust this term right here to, all right, we should have it be longer for some things and shorter for others. But the problem is that you could use a different kind of lens to view a particular invention, and with that lens, you could kind of make it look like whatever you want it to look like.
When you file a patent, is it made public at that time?
It publishes after 18 months, okay. But it's secret until that publication.
So you might have a situation where you file
Yes, absolutely. Sometimes it makes more sense to hold something back as a trade secret and be able to say, I'm not going to file for a patent on this. I'm just going to go ahead and not tell anyone about it. Trade secret. Like, I'm just not going to tell anyone about it. No, the military is actually...
That's a whole separate thing.
That's a patent application that you file and just kind of... kind of like falls into some kind of black hole and you don't even know where it goes. I've only heard about a couple of those. I've never actually had one myself. Yes?
You've had this trade secret. You've had it for 5 years. And somebody comes out with a patent and starts suing you.
That's a problem. That's the big problem about trade secrets.
And there's people who collect these ideas and patent them, like the barcode thing, and sue everybody, even though the barcodes have been in force for 10 years.
But if you could prove that you were selling it before they issued their file with patent, you don't have a legal position.
You don't have a legal position, because let's go back. I'm not going to go all the way back, but there's one of the things that to the patentable requirements. The ones that you were talking about, actually, you brought up earlier about the timing issues. If something is published, if something is publicly used, or something is sold, then those things will prevent others from actually doing that and patenting those things. But if you hold it as a trade secret, you're not publishing it, you're not telling anyone about it, you're just keeping it as a trade secret within your manufacturing factory. You're not telling anyone about it. You're not getting it out in the public, by definition. Of the trade secret. And that's not what the government wants. The government wants, and society wants, for others to be able to stand on your shoulders. They want you to file the patent, so they want you to file the patent application, so you teach everyone how to use it, and then after 20 years it expires, and then everyone else could do it. That's what they want.
Do
And so there's this, sure, you could go ahead and file or not file a patent application and hold it as a trade secret, which is a heck of a lot cheaper. All you have to do is go down to Office Depot and buy one of those confidentiality stamps and then just use it. Boom. 50 cents later, you have yourself a trade secret. A heck of a lot cheaper than 10 grand in dealing with a patent attorney. But then you have that little problem. Someone else comes along, comes up with the same idea, and patents it, and is now trying to stop you from doing it. Yeah?
So it sounds as if there's an art to writing a patent application where you don't divulge everything that you
require? Yes. Yes. You have to, right now the patents require you to tell them to include your best mode, the best way of doing it, which is a decent number of details. But you can craft the claims such that, all right, well, I'm going to take this part of the invention, and it's going to be public, and we're going to file a patent application. And this part of the invention, we're going to hold that as a trade secret and not tell anyone about it. And yes, there's an art to doing that. What is this thing? So this thing right here is a radio. Here are your little earbuds. And this thing right here is a pump. It's a little hand pump. This thing doesn't have batteries. It's just a little hand pump. You put this thing, you put it around your neck, and you start running with this thing. You got this thing in your hand, and you're just going to go ahead and give it a pump every once in a while. What does it remind you of? A little bit of like the hand crank radio, in the sense that it doesn't have batteries, and you could just go ahead and like, you know, enter some kind of mechanical energy to it. On its face, do you think that this would infringe that hand crank radio patent? I mean, does it look like it? No. It doesn't look like it at all. But then think about this a little bit further. You got a radio. You got something where you put your hand, you enter some mechanical energy. It plays. Probably have a spring in there. Probably have even a circuit board. Control circuit to kind of help with this, like, this release of energy. Does this thing infringe?
It might. The hand crank didn't actually specify a crank. It specified a shaft that rotated. And so if you're blowing air across the shaft that rotates...
Maybe that's your little shaft, and maybe that's the thing that rotates?
Then, yes, then maybe you are infringing.
So the thing is, there's no director...
Only matters what they claim. Thank you. Let's actually go back to the claim. It's got a generator. It's got a rotatable shaft. It's got some gears, a mechanical energy storage device. It's got that spring. You know, you've got some place to put your hand, power control circuit, a radio coupled to all that. Does it infringe? Why? What do you think, if you were trying to design around this, what would you say? Or if you were the patent attorney and said, don't worry about it because you don't have... The handle. Why did they even put the handle in there? This was the patentable part, right? This whole control circuit. Why did they even put the handle in there? A handle coupled to the source, whereby rotating the handle adds mechanical energy to the source. Why couldn't this just be a mechanical input device where a user can insert mechanical energy? This could have been a little push button. This could have been like a little slide or a lever that you push back and forth. Could be, but let's just stick to mechanical energy, just a human mechanical energy. There are a couple of different ways to do this. Why did they write it like this? Because this was the invention. And it's so hard for everyone involved, the patent attorney and the inventor, to figure out, to think about that. This is why patent applications cost so much. Because all you have at the end of the day is one sentence to try to enforce your patent against someone else. All you have is that claim. And if your claim includes a couple of extra words right there, whereby rotating the handle adds mechanical energy to the source, then all of a sudden you can't use this patent to, you can't enforce this patent over the guy with the little pump.
But you could use it to invalidate the other person's patent. Because this is a public document. So if there's nothing novel in there, it's...
But I think there might be something actually novel about this thing. Yeah. I mean, I think this thing could actually be patentable. And if they would have rewritten that claim just a little bit, they might have actually had an infringement here. I don't think it has this handle, and I don't think it infringes. It's kind of in the summary of the of the infringement side of this lecture. Whoa! Oh, that was really exciting. The product and the method may infringe a patent if it contains all of the elements of a single claim. How many claims are in this patent that I showed you? Twenty. So if it infringes, if another product infringes any of those 20 claims, then it infringes that particular patent.
So is that the only claim in the other patent?
No, there are actually about 14 of them. Dependent claims often are always narrow the claim. And so if you don't infringe an independent claim, you're not going to infringe a dependent claim.
Okay. So the way to use the dependent claim would be to make the first one general and then to have
right.
a bunch of dependent when they say a bomb.
Right. Exactly. Yes?
So we can patent an improvement for existing patent.
Yes. That's very important. Keep that in mind. I'm going to kind of put this all together for you in the next couple of minutes.
For trade secrets, you're trying to revamp your improvement.
What's that?
Trade secrets are bank for your improvement.
Yep. I'm going to try to pull this all together. So, now what we have here is a hand crank radio with a solar panel on top. I want you to turn to your neighbor. I want you to talk with your neighbor about, is this thing patentable? And does this thing infringe the particular patents that we've already talked about? Two questions. Is this thing patentable? And does it infringe? Supposed to stop? Yes. I just have a couple more slides. All right, this group right here. Is this thing patentable? You disagree. All right. Any group agrees? What do you guys? Is it patentable?
We think it is.
Why?
It's a combination.
I think it's an improvement of the invention.
What do you think might be patentable about it? We got a couple of different things going on here, right? You got a hand crank and you got the solar. And like, when do you take the solar power? When do you go off of the spring? There's something that's actually modulating between those two energy sources that you don't find in the prior art. And so maybe if you focus on that, maybe you'd be able to get a patent on that, you know, make sure that you include that particular concept. Great. So this thing is patentable. Does it infringe? Why? Because it contains all of the elements of it, but it has more. Look at this. It's got a solar panel on top. How could it infringe? It doesn't matter that it has the solar panel on top. It has all of the elements of something else. It has more, but it doesn't matter because it has all of those elements. And so this thing infringes. So this thing is patentable because nothing in the prior art has a control circuit for enabling the generator and the solar panel to charge a capacitor. So therefore, this thing is patentable. It infringes, however, because it has every single element of Claim 11. That's kind of weird. What did we just say? This thing is patentable and it infringes. So let's go back to this initial question. What is the relationship between patentability and infringement? The satellite radio, the one that we just looked at. No. This is the red one. Remember with XM? We said it's not patentable, yet it would infringe because it has all of those elements. What if we actually made a 1970s Panasonic radio that was identical to the 1970s Panasonic radio? Well, there's not going to be any infringement there because any patents that are that old are going to be now long expired. And it's certainly not going to be patentable because that thing has been done. So we have not patentable and no infringement. Patentable and infringement. We have the solar free play radio, the one that we just looked at. It's patentable and it infringes. And over here, we have an air pump radio, the one that had the little squeeze, hand squeeze thing. No infringement there, and it was patentable. All four right there. There's no relationship whatsoever between these two ideas. So you could get a patent. So what does this really mean? Well, you could go ahead and get a patent and you could prevent others from doing this. But if your patent is really just an improvement upon someone else's patent, then they're going to be able to stop you from making that. Who can make the solar free play radio? It's patentable. Let's say it actually has a patent. And it infringes. Who can make that thing? No, because then he's going to infringe the second one.
Whoever licenses both.
No one can make it. This happens all the time. There's 7 million patents. We stand on each other's shoulders. We improve. We make improvements. We combine things. This happens all the time. To be able to actually make this thing, you'd actually have to go to the original owner and say, I want your rights. I'm the improver, and I want to be able to make this. I'll give you a certain amount of money. Or maybe it goes the other way. You go to the guy, you go to the solar, you go to Free Play Radio and say, look, I improved your invention. You can't make this thing because I have a patent on it. But I'll sell you this patent because you already have this thing all figured out. You already have the distribution channels and you already have marketing. Just go ahead and slap your name on it and you're going to be able to sell this thing for an extra 10, 20 bucks. So it comes down to licensing. It comes down to agreements and business arrangements. Any questions? That's what I have. I'll be available after class if you want to ask me any questions.